Good evening, church, and thank you very much for being here tonight. It is good to see everybody, and I'm glad that we get to spend another evening spending a little bit of time in the Word of God and talking about spiritual growth. I've been told this week very much, and I hope that you have as well. I've kind of tried most nights not to spend too much time on personal comments, but if you'll indulge me for just a moment, I would like to say something. We have tonight a handful of members from the Eastland Church, and there have been, I think, every evening some members from the Eastland Church, and I appreciate that very sincerely. That you are my brothers and my sisters, and I want you to know that I consider you my friends, in all sincerity. And I'm very grateful that you came tonight. And to those of you who are members of this congregation that I have been getting to know this week, I'm, again, the same sentiment. You are my brothers and my sisters, and I am grateful that this week we've been able to become friends. And I thank you very much for that. I'm enjoying myself immensely, and so just extremely thankful to God for this opportunity to be with you all week. Every living thing goes through broadly the same life cycle. It grows until it begins to decline. And so plant life, that's what happens. Animal life, that's pretty much what happens. The human body, that's pretty much what happens. It grows and excels and develops until it peaks, and then the decline begins. But the human spirit, the human soul, the consciousness, if you like, doesn't have to be that way. We've been talking from the very beginning about how that life cycle works, from the beginning of this series, about how we either are growing or declining. And I believe that's true in the case of the human soul, that we are either growing or declining. But I don't believe that decline necessarily has to be inevitable, as it is in the physical realm. Growth does not necessarily have to stop unless we stop cultivating it. We can expect it to continue. It is interesting and worthwhile, I think, to note the difference between physical life and spiritual life. Where physical growth is limited just by the virtue of time and space, it's just the way it goes, spiritual growth seems, at least to me, to be not only limitless in this time, but limitless in all of eternity. That as long as God is still greater than us, we still have room to grow. And I think that's interesting then, because it sets us up really well for what we want to talk about tonight. When it seems like spiritual growth is ready to stop, what do we do? If growth doesn't have to stop, then what should we do when it seems like it's about to? When we're in decline, when we reach that turning point where, again, it doesn't have to stop, but it feels like it's about to, when we reach that decision moment, then we have a couple of different options. And I'll tell you, I think we reach that moment in different ways, especially in terms of our individual spiritual growth. We reach that moment in different ways. Maybe we get caught in sin. Now, whatever sin is in your life, it suddenly is exposed and is known. And now you have a decision. You have a decision. Is growth going to continue, or are we going to use this to continue the decline? Maybe the church is depending on us for something, and then they suddenly realize that we're not as spiritually mature as we ought to be. And their realizing it makes us realize it. We have a turning point there. What are we going to do? Maybe it's just a series of teachings, like a sermon series or Bible classes or a podcast or whatever it is, that convicts us that, you know, I've really been declining spiritually. And when we realize it, we face a turning point. If any of those is the case where you are tonight, or where you feel like your congregation may be, then that's what this message is about. It's about that moment of realization. And what are you going to do with that moment? Are we going to let growth stop, even though it doesn't have to? Or are we going to do a few things to get ourselves out of the way and let God keep giving the growth that He always intends to give? Tonight I'm going to give you four options for when you hit the turning point. Four options to either let growth die or keep it going. Let me go ahead and tell you on the front end, if you got one of those study guides, we're going to spend the majority of our time on point number one and then just sort of run through two, three, and four to finish things up. All right, the first step when we face the turning point is to either accept or reject the truth. The first step is really just to face the reality of where we actually are. Matter of fact, the first step toward changing anything is admitting the true current state. In any 12-step program, be it Alcoholics Anonymous or any other iteration thereof, 6 of the 12 steps have something to do with admitting where we are. Half of the program is about admitting the truth of what's really going on at this turning point in my life. Facing the facts is the most important part of this whole process. And so, God likes to tell, it seems, turning point stories in the Bible. And in all of them, He shows us an example of somebody coming to a realization of the truth. So let me give you 4 examples here. 4 examples of stories that God told about people who reached a turning point. Number 1 is King Manasseh. King Manasseh in 2 Chronicles 33 turns from being the worst king in all of Israelite history through both kingdoms, as far as I'm concerned, from being the worst there is to a devoted servant of God. He goes through his turning point and comes out better for it. Nehemiah. Nehemiah is another story. In Nehemiah, really chapter 2, but the whole of the book, comes into Jerusalem and turns Jerusalem from rubble into a thriving metropolis for the glory of God again. He faces the turning point and comes out well on the other side. Ezra is another example, as he comes back shortly after Nehemiah, right around the same time really, and the people during his time, and especially in Ezra chapter 9 and 10, that should be 9 and 10 there on the study guide, the people turn away from the marriages that they were in, that were forbidden by the law in a grand pursuit of the holiness of God. And then Paul. Paul is a great example of somebody that hit the turning point and handled it the right way. Himself turning from imprisoning anybody who followed Christ to preaching about Christ to much of the known world. All 4 of them then faced this crucial turning point. And the first step for all of them was to either accept or reject the truth about where they were. King Manasseh, if you remember the story, was thrown into a foreign prison. And it was there that he had to face the truth about a life he had led of violence and idolatry. Nehemiah was told the horrible truth about the city of his God while working for a foreign king. And in that moment, he had to face the truth. He had to realize the truth about what could be done. Ezra is in the process of leading the spiritual restoration of his people when he gets to chapter 9 and he's blindsided by the truth that they were living in sinful marriages. And Paul was on his way to arrest people for following Christ when he was literally blinded by the truth that Jesus said, "I am the one you are persecuting." In all 4 cases, the first thing they had to do on the way back toward growth was admit the truth. And so it must also be our first step when we face a turning point. If we're declining, if spiritual growth is dying, while we know that we ought to preserve it, we must begin by admitting the decline. I know that seems obvious enough, but let me show you exactly how hard that can be to do. Because as much as Christians are supposed to be people that, as Brother Reggie prayed a little while ago, are the pillar and the ground of the truth, sometimes we're not willing to accept the truth when it's looking us right in the face. Case in point, our matter of growth tonight. How many of us, raise your hand if you want to, you don't have to, but how many of us know that we need to grow? Honesty would put all of our hands up, exactly, okay? How many of us would be willing to admit, though, that we are the reason we're not growing? Maybe, yeah. How many of us would be willing to admit if we were the reason that the church is not growing? Fewer hands go up. That the reasons that we aren't growing are because we aren't actually following God's truth. How many of us would be willing to admit that? And fewer hands go up. The truth about where you actually are and what growth is actually needed must be realized, and it must be admitted if we're going to let it happen. Two other examples to give you here from the churches in Asia in Revelation chapter 3. Two perfect examples here of how we just kind of have a tendency to overlook what is true. The Lord says to the church at Sardis in chapter 3 and verse 1, I know your works. You have the reputation of being alive. That's what they think. The truth that hits them between the eyes is, but you are dead. Wake up, for strengthen what remains and is about to die. For I have found your works, I have not found your works complete in the sight of my God. We think we're doing fine. It seems like we're doing fine. But the truth that we have to admit is that the Lord says we're dead. And then the very next one in the list, Laodicea. Laodicea, about that church, the Lord speaking to them, you say, I am rich, I have prospered, I need nothing. The reality, you don't realize that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. Those churches, again, we have individuals there in the top part of the list. Those churches in the bottom part of the list think that they are going to grow, but they have refused to admit the truth of where they really are. So how do we do the same? What do we do when it comes to this turning point where we have to face the truth? Well, number one, for personal growth, which we have tried it throughout the week to talk about it on a personal level and on a church level. When it comes to personal growth, we got to be willing to face the truth, the reality of our relationship with God. And I don't mean necessarily to say there, we need to face the truth about how much we're doing for God. That may be part of it. But what I'm really talking about is how much do we love God? How much is our heart devoted to God? Not just our actions and our calendars, but the heart that governs the action and the calendar. Many believers do a lot. We attend lots of studies, teach lots of neighbors and friends. We worship frequently. We participate in lots of things with the church. And yet, we continue to harbor and foster intense desires for sin in our hearts. Thinking things like, well, you know, if only I weren't a Christian, I could do that, I could go there, I could have them, I could say this. We still desire that which we should not desire. Or we do a lot while we continually harbor and foster hateful attitudes toward our brethren in our hearts. You know, I will never forgive something like that. Nobody could forgive that. Christ could, and we're called to be like Him. But when we continue to foster the hatefulness, it stands in the way of growth. Or we continually harbor and foster a secret sin. That's just my little secret. I'm sure it won't hurt anybody as long as they don't find out. And yet the truth about that for a believer is that if we know holiness and we consciously choose the sin over God, we're not depending on grace anymore to save us because we are completely rejecting the grace of God to overcome that sin. And so we face a turning point. If this is where we find ourselves, we face a turning point. And if, sincerely, if you find right now that I'm talking to you and your mind is racing, trying to rationalize your behavior and your mindset, can I just encourage you to slow down for a second and be honest and face the facts? Because if that's where you are at a turning point for growth. And my question is, are you going to reject what's evidently true about where you are? Or are you just going to say, well, that's not really me that's about. That's not really my fault that all that's happening. I don't believe it's really that bad. It's a turning point. Are we going to fail or are we going to finish? Which answer is it? And then when it comes to the church, we need to be able to do the same thing. We must be willing to face the facts. Sometimes we really prefer to look at the church through rose-colored glasses. Tom Rainer, in his book Breakout Churches, tells about being called to consult with several churches. He was brought in to look at their attendance, their leadership, and their programs to see where is the greatest potential for growth. And in several cases, he talked about, in that book, where he would present findings to the church that they were in decline, either spiritually or numerically or both. And in many of those cases, he would be met with a chorus of denial. A chorus of denial. When the numbers showed a steady decline in attendance, the brethren would say something like, well, those numbers just can't be right. Okay, when testing showed that the church's overall Bible knowledge was very low, the response was usually, no, it's not. Our Bible classes are great. And so the last line in that little section of his book, as he talks about all that, the last line as he talks about one of those churches, it says they continue their slow erosion to this day. Why? Because they were unwilling to face the facts about growth and decline. Facts that we don't want to face, I understand, but which we must face if we're going to truly seek the growth that God would give. And so here then are four areas in which we as church members and church leaders must consider when it comes to either accepting or rejecting the truth in our turning points. Number one, the truth. We must accept or reject the truth regarding doctrinal knowledge. Does our church know the teachings of the Bible? I'm not concerned with whether a church holds the tenets of a particular denomination or group of churches. Not concerned with that. My question is, do we know the teachings of the Bible, the doctrine of God? We need to answer that question honestly when we hit this turning point. Number two, we need to face the truth about evangelistic zeal. Does the church actively participate in the spread of the gospel? Are we all the light of the world, the salt of the earth, Matthew chapter 5? If so, how many people are involved? How deeply are they involved? Are they actually teaching the gospel of Jesus Christ? We need to answer these questions honestly when we face the turning point. Number three, we need to talk about, honestly, about the relevance of what we're doing. Sometimes we find ourselves as a church facilitating Bible classes, preaching series, VBSs, live streaming our services, having a ladies' Bible class, all sorts of things. And we just need to be honest about whether the kinds of things that we're facilitating there are actually helpful. I told you in another message in this series about the church that for years they went verse by verse through Matthew, then Mark, then Luke, then John, then Acts, then Matthew, then Mark, then Luke, then John, then Acts. And if you had asked them why you're doing that, the answer would have been, because that's the way we do things. And if you had said to them, well, do you think it's helping anybody? The answer would have to be, I don't know. It's just what we do. Brothers and sisters, that is not a good enough answer. That is just not a good enough answer. We need to face the facts. We need to be honest about answering the question, are our programs and our efforts actually helpful? And answering that question honestly is one of the prerequisites to the turning point, either growth or decline. And then fourth here, we need to face reality about unity or division. Do we spend more effort as a church on teaching the lost or on fighting the saved? Do we spend more effort on teaching those who are outside or arguing with those who are inside? What kinds of division exist within the body that are hindering God-given growth? As we have said several times throughout, the more we focus on ourselves and neglect to focus on others first, the more poorly things will go. People who are constantly looking out and looking ahead for teaching opportunities and evangelism and godly spiritual growth, people who are looking for that will have so much less time to fight with each other. And so, is that where we're expending the majority of our time and our energy? And we need to answer that question honestly. You've heard of Harry S. Truman, President of the United States in World War II. I know you've heard of him. You may or may not have heard of Harry R. Truman. Harry R. Truman lived in a house at the bottom of Mount St. Helens. And when it was well known that the mountain was getting ready to explode, the volcano was getting ready to erupt, Harry R. Truman was told multiple times, you've got to get out of here. It's going to explode. And as best we can tell, your house sits right in the path of the lava flow. You have got to get out of here. And he continually told them, it's not going to happen. I'm not leaving. And you know what happened? We have got to face the facts when it comes to the turning point. Are we going to grow, or are we going to refuse, and are we going to let things die? Whether our own spirits or the spiritual growth of the church, let's be honest about where we are so that we can appropriately take the next steps. Now, that element is the most crucial part of the process because it is the first step. If you can't admit there's a problem, there will be no turning point. You'll just continue along the same linear decline that you're on, and things will fall apart completely eventually. But once we decide to face the truth and accept it and work with it, what do we do next? Well, the next element of the turning point is to decide, are we going to walk by faith or are we going to walk by sight? And the preferred answer is obvious to any Bible student. The Bible clearly says in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7, we walk by faith and not by sight. And God has shown us several turning points where that's precisely what happened, and He made some serious growth happen. And so the same four stories from a few minutes ago illustrate this. King Manasseh, sitting in a prison in Babylon, has no idea what's going to happen if he repents. He had to just believe that God would fulfill the promises of restoration that God had made long before that. Nehemiah, when he leaves the king's presence and he's heading back to restore the city of Jerusalem, you see the repeated refrain in his book, "The hand of the Lord was upon me for good." That's a sign of faith, that we walk by faith, not by sight. In Ezra, can I invite you actually to turn to Ezra and take a look at chapter 10? In Ezra chapter 10, there's a couple of verses that I want to read there and just show you something about how faith worked for these people. When they realized they were married to people that they should not be married to, that they were forbidden by law to marry, here's what happens. Ezra chapter 10, starting with verse 2. He says, the people say rather, we have broken faith with our God and have married foreign women from the peoples of the land. But even now there is hope for Israel in spite of this. That sounds like faith to me. Therefore, let us make a covenant with our God to put away all these wives and their children according to the counsel of my Lord and of those who tremble at the commandment of our God. Let it be done according to the law. Ezra, arise, for it is your task and we are with you. Be strong and do it. Now scan down to verse 6. Three verses later, Ezra was mourning over the faithlessness of the exiles. How did we get here, Ezra? How did we reach this point where we need the turning point so badly? We did it because of our faithlessness. We broke faith with God. And so now we have decided we are going to walk by faith. And then fourth one, Paul. Paul literally walked by faith and not by sight from that spot on the Damascus Road. And from there, he responded by faith in Christ, so much so that the text says in Acts chapter 9 and verse 22 that Saul grew. He increased all the more in strength. The point is that they moved before they knew what would happen next. They did things God's way for His glory in faith that the growth would come. And it actually kind of presents a bit of a paradox when you consider the first point from this evening in view of this one. Because we kind of feel like it shows a lack of faith to admit that a church isn't growing. It shows a lack of faith to say, I have been getting further from God. If we had real faith, we think that we would be able to say, God, I know things look bad, but I don't believe that because I believe in you. And they're not opposite each other. They're just not opposite. They have to work together, in fact, in order for this turning point to happen. It doesn't have to be either or. These four stories demonstrate that it is both. We must retain faith that God's way of growth will prevail no matter the difficulties. And at the same time, we have to confront even the most brutal facts of our current reality. And so the question is, when we face reality, are we going to walk by faith or by sight? Some personal applications of ways that you might put this to work. I'll just give you a list here. I'll put it on the screen. You can fill it in on the worksheet. You can think about some of your own ways to apply this. But when you hit the turning point of decline or growth, whichever you choose from there, in your family, are you going to walk by faith or by sight? In your prayer life, are you going to face the turning point in your life trusting that God will actually listen and make growth happen? When you face the turning point of decline or growth in evangelism, Will I recognize then that I have been neglecting the job that God has given and actually turn to it? In terms of benevolence, am I going to be willing to give to others even though it seems like giving to others will leave me with nothing? That takes some faith to believe that God will keep it, will keep us the way He has promised. In leadership, that in positions that I hold as a leader, in forgiving others, will I walk by faith or by sight? And in doctrine, in just what I believe to be true, will I believe that God's word is truth even when it is extremely difficult to believe? Will I believe in the Bible's truth that Jesus really rose from the dead and that all people who follow Christ, not just some that are like me, but everyone who follows Christ is my brother or my sister? Will I have the faith or will I just try to walk by sight? Those are turning point questions when you realize that growth is needed in your life. And again, when a church hits its turning point, will we? We will have to make a choice to walk by faith or walk by sight. In what we teach, do we believe the gospel is enough or we need something else or something more? In the way that we fellowship, in the leadership that we have, do we believe that God's plan is enough and is good enough or do we need something different or something more? In the submission, in our submission to the leadership of God's church, are we going to walk by faith or by sight? I had a conversation with somebody a couple of days ago that I think this one is a major turning point factor here. You're well aware of the fact that Hebrews 13 and verse 17 says, "Obey your leaders and submit to them, for they are keeping watch over your souls as those who will have to give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with groaning, for that would be of no advantage to you." I'll show you two things about that passage really quickly that take faith. Number one, that is a direct command from God. We always talk about there's ways that God communicates His authority. Command and example, a necessary inference, right? That one is a direct command. Obey your leaders. And I don't mean for, and I don't think God intends for leaders in the church to use that to wield it over their memberships. I do think that God intends for those of us who are under their oversight to take it as seriously as a command ought to be taken, that we obey our leaders as those who watch over us. The second thing I want to show you there is the second half of that verse says, "Let them do this with joy and not with groaning." I think typically we read that and it means those of you who are elders, don't, you know, make sure that you're joyful. Make sure that you're not doing this begrudgingly. I think it's actually speaking to the rest of us that we give them the opportunity to lead us without making them groan to do so, without making them miserable. And so are we going to walk by faith in doing that, even when they make decisions that we don't agree with? Are we going to let them lead us with joy? Because we walk by faith and not by sight. It's a turning point for a church when we decide whether we're going to do that or do it right or do it wrong. And then in maintaining a focus on others, do we walk by faith that God will make growth happen if we do that? And then in just believing that God will continue to do good and bless with growth in the future. Again, we can plant and we can water, but if we walk by faith, we will. And we will expect God to continue to give the growth. Number three, the reality of a turning point, wherever it comes, whether on a personal level or a corporate level, is that it will, not it might, it will require sacrifices. You want to see God-given growth in anything? It will require sacrifices on your part. And so again, I reference you to the same four stories of turning points. Manasseh, when he comes back from prison, he is reinstated as the king. He tears down the idols, reinstitutes temple worship, restructures the kingdom around following God. Listen, if nothing else, that would have been a procedural headache. Plus, lots of lost cost in purchasing and building all the idols in the first place. He had to make sacrifices. Number two, Nehemiah left his job working in the royal palace to essentially become a construction foreman. It's a big move. It's a major difference in mentality. There's lost perks, there's lost prestige, and there's very little gained for Nehemiah by doing all of that. He had to make sacrifices. Ezra had to tell the people a very hard message. That is an emotional sacrifice all by itself. had to tell his people a very hard message. And more than that, the people who were so intent on pursuing the truth and holiness of God, they sacrificed their own families in the pursuit of God-given spiritual growth. It's absolutely crushing to look at Ezra chapter 10 and verse 44, the last verse of his little book, after he's given a long list of those who have married the foreign women. The last verse of Ezra says, all these had married foreign women, and some of them had even borne children. And they sent them all away. And called for sacrifices. And Paul gives up a place of prestigious advancement within his culture. He gives up the power of pursuing Christians to being pursued by the Jews. He goes from a personal commission given by the high priest in the first two verses of Acts 9 to standing on trial before another high priest in chapter 23. And, as if that weren't, a bad enough change, that high priest in chapter 23 is commanding the people standing around Paul, hit him. Strike him in the mouth for what he's saying here. Paul's humiliated. He's absolutely humiliated before the same people who before held him up on a pedestal. And why? Because the growth of God's kingdom was so important to him. He loved his people. That's evident from his letter to the Romans. And yet he was willing to make sacrifices where they were necessary because growth costs something. And that's the thing. That's where the turning point happens. That's where the turning point continues in decline or pursues God-given growth. That we either count the cost and determine that it's worth it, or we count the cost and we decide to just cut the losses. One will lead from the turning point into growth. The other, even while it seems like self-preservation, will lead from the turning point into further decline. And I will say this again, growth will, not might, it will require sacrifices. And so if you're at the turning point in your personal life, here are some of the sacrifices that you may have to make. Many of them that you will have to make. Number one, you will have to sacrifice your own will. Number two, likely have to sacrifice your comfort. Growth and complacency don't go well together. Number three, it will often cost in a sacrifice of my time, giving it to others, pursuing growth. It takes time. It will often manifest itself in a sacrifice of my money. There's some things that you just have to spend in order to grow. I think a very small example of that would be buying books. Right? You expect a preacher to be a good reader. We spend a lot of money on books, y'all. You buy a lot of books, and the same is true of anybody that wants to truly grow. You want to read. You want to develop your skills in some area. There's a cost there. I think of other more significant examples. You want to grow in the fellowship that you have with other saints? Just the cost of food to have a common meal together. And sometimes it's going to cost us in money. Number five, it will sometimes cost me a sacrifice in my own personally held doctrines. Not the doctrines of the Bible, I don't mean that. But in the beliefs that I hold dear to my heart, that somehow, now that I'm growing spiritually, the Bible has come to challenge what I have always held to be true. And am I going to be willing to let go of what I have held to be true? And then ultimately, the cost to me is going to be my pride. And that's a good thing. Matter of fact, that's probably the best thing that can happen to us, is if we do something that costs us our pride. In terms of the church and its growth, the cost to the church will often be very much the same. Number one, it will cost us our complacency. If we're really comfortable, we're not willing to grow, yeah, we're going to have to give that up. That's just reality. Number two, it will cost us our resources. When it comes time to help brothers and sisters, to take up a collection and send it to Jerusalem, to the brethren who are experiencing a famine in Judea, when it comes time to do that, it's going to cost us some of our own resources to help them. That's growth of the kingdom, though, brothers. That's a good thing if we're willing to make it happen. The turning point is going to cost us, many times, our patience. Because there are going to be those among our fellowships that are just a little more difficult to work with. You know, they become a Christian and we want to see them just immediately become a mature Christian on day two. And it doesn't work that way. We have to be willing to be patient with them, to help them along the way as they pursue growth. And if we're not willing to do that, that's when we face a turning point. Are we going to help? Are we going to reject them? Are we going to neglect them? Number four, it will cost us sacrifices in our emotions as we deal with the pain caused by others, as we deal with the frustration of needing to be patient. And all of that ultimately boils down to the fact that it will cost us our pride. And so again, when we face a turning point, fail or finish, are we going to grow? Are we going to die? We have to decide, are we willing to make these sacrifices, pay the cost, or just cut the losses? And then finally, number four for this evening, we have the choice when we face the turning point to either work or just walk away. Again, the same four stories. Manasseh, when he comes back, he tears down the idols and he reinstates the worship of Jehovah. He gets to work. Nehemiah rebuilds the wall in 52 days, restabilizes the city. It's an amazing bit of work that he undertakes. Ezra, it's a lot of work involved. It took him a couple of months actually putting all of that together to send away their wives and children and follow God. And then Paul. Paul started preaching immediately and passionately. When they faced the turning point, they had the option to walk away